We have with us today David Guggenheim, known as the Ocean Doctor, Senior Fellow of the Ocean Foundation and Director, Cuba Marine Research and Conservation Program. Jorge Piñon, Oil and Gas Expert and Visiting Research Fellow from the Cuban Research Institute, Latin America and Caribbean Center of Florida International University. John Prony, Executive Director, Applied Research Center, Florida International University. He's also former Director, Ocean Chemistry Division, Atlantic Oceanographic and Meteorological Laboratory, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And last but never least, Dan Whittle, Cuba Program Director, Environmental Defense Fund. And good morning to all of you gentlemen. And John Prony, let me start with you. How do we define, first of all, talk to us a little bit. Each of you, each of these gentlemen will have 8 to 10 minutes as introductory statements. We're going to have then a conversation amongst ourselves, and then we will open it up to you for questions. I am advised that SCJ rules are that only registered journalists are allowed to ask questions. When you do ask questions, please identify yourselves and who you are affiliated with. John Prony, describe the landscape to us, and damage to the environment can mean multiple things.
That is correct.
Thank you, Jorge. The enterprise of developing an oil field or a production area has a long lifetime, and many things can occur in that lifetime. The act of drilling generates a series of energy releases, such as underwater sound and seismic energy, which then were not there before. In the process of drilling, one can create produced waters or utilize drilling fluids. In the United States, the evolution of drilling fluids has been towards synthetic fluids. In abroad, it's not so clear. There are also requirements on the treatment of produced waters, which, as you may know, vary in their ratio relative to the oil produced, depending on the age of the field. Things such as produced waters and drilling fluids can have both local impacts to corals or other organisms, but can also have distal impacts, particularly in conjunction with a transport system that exists in the Caribbean and Gulf, which here off of Florida we call the Gulf Stream, it's the Florida Strait Currents, the Loop Current, and it emanates from the Caribbean and comes into the Gulf. That current has the possibility of transporting oil and other materials very quickly to the areas of the United States, particularly South Florida. Now, there are many subtleties in oil production. For example, there is consideration of the connection of the Cuban reefs to the Florida reefs. Are there, for example, recruitment processes which link these two reefs? There's also the issues of larval transport north of Cuba through the current systems. Once a producing oil field exists, releases of materials such as drilling fluids or produced waters can impact these transiting organisms. Oil itself, for our circumstances here, we would hope that the best, highest quality control technology to prevent accidents would be utilized. But realistically speaking, these checks that we might be able to do would be done in the non-in-situ situation. That is to say that the checks might be done external to the Cuban exclusive economic zone, but might not be transited or carried out during the actual operation within the zone. Now, in the worst case circumstance where there is a spill, as I mentioned, there is the possibility of rapid transport of that spill to U.S. waters. The exact details of how this will go depends on several factors, one of which, for example, is the position of the leak relative to the northward position of the flowing current. If, in the course of the development of a field, the current is straddled by the production wells, then there are a range of possibilities as to how the entrainment of the fluid might occur. Now, if the fluid is entrained, then it has the possibilities of visiting, perhaps, the Kaysal Bank, or, in the case of Florida, we have what is known as upwelling that occurs here off the South Florida coast. In the case of upwelling, deeper water, which is generally under the Gulf Stream proper, the Gulf Stream is largely a surface current contained in the upper 100 or so meters, can be transported onto Florida coral reefs. So then we have to consider the impact to the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary of current transport. There's also wind transport. But besides the Florida Keys Sanctuary, there is the issue of the infiltration of oil into canals, inlets, cuts, and any other systems which act as sallying points for freshwater, but also could be recipient channels for incoming tides and phenomena of this type. So those are the general type of environmental issues. Now, there are ecotoxicological studies that need to be carried out for various type organisms, and there also has to be an understanding of the specific physiological effects that might transpire. Another component that we need to look at, that needs to be examined, is the characterization of the oil itself. Oil is a dynamic quantity, and the way and form it appears when it's in the vicinity of an immediate leak area will evolve as it progresses. Sometimes the so-called weathering occurs. But actually, there are many dynamical changes that can occur, and these changes are complicated when dispersants might be introduced. This is a field of research, the introduction of dispersants to oil and ecotological effects, toxicological effects. So the people of Cuba should have some thinking about how issues might affect their valuable reefs and their valuable environmental assets. At the same time, thinking is required here. Now, in keeping with our timing, I've given you a rather brief overview, but I am leaving here a analysis of several oil issues. We were involved with the Ixtoc spill. We were involved with the Deepwater Horizon spill. We were involved with the release of drilling fluids and produced waters in the Flower Garden banks. Timing of the understanding of when a release occurs is extremely valuable. It turns out that in the case of shallow oil pools that can be produced in the event of a leak, these can be detected and outlined using underwater sound. If you know that, and there are some illustrations of that from the Ixtoc well, you could send tankers to this area, lower nozzles that are sealed, hoses with sealed nozzles, into the subsurface pools and actually pump the oil out of the ocean. But this requires early timing and knowledge of what's transpiring, because quickly the oil dilutes, mixes, and in the event of systems such as hurricanes, the mixing is very quick and goes throughout the water column. There are also longer-term effects wherein the oil can work its way into beaches and sediments. A famous example of that is what occurred in Blind Pass in St. Petersburg, Florida, where oil from a barge accident in Tampa Bay made its way down to its pass in St. Petersburg and passed its way into the sediment. It remained there for a number of years. 15 years after the incident, the Corps of Engineers went to dredge that channel to make it a bit deeper. The channel sediments passed the initial tests that the Corps undertook, but once they began drilling, the dredging, oil appeared 6 centimeters beneath the surface. The water turned black, The Coast Guard ordered the Corps of Engineers to cease operations and, I am told, issued a citation for an oil spill. This was remarkable that a dredging operation would result in an oil spill.
Mm-hmm.
So the end point here is there's a lot of considerations.
There is a lot of consideration. And, John, and I'd like to say that if you're interested in the topic, we do have a number of copies of his presentation, Dr. Prony's presentation, which is absolutely wonderful, and it's got graphs and charts which will help you in the discussion. David Guggenheim, clearly, as Dr. Prony talks, there are a number of environmental issues that need to be taken into account. Because we live here in the United States, our big focus is on what happens to the environment in the United States, but clearly Dr. Prony also indicates that there's significant question as to what can happen in the environment in Cuba. How often, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an oil spill, how often is the environment damaged because of oil or gas drilling?
How often in Cuba or in general?
In general. If we want to look at, since this is brand new to Cuba, we can't measure the safety standards of how they behave when it comes to oil drilling. But when we talk about oil drilling in general, how safe or unsafe is it as an industry? Of course, we have the BP oil spill, but throughout the years, how safe or unsafe is it?
Well, in general, if you look at the record, there are not a lot of Deepwater Horizon scale oil spills or Exxon Valdez's. That's good news, and certainly technology has improved. What obviously has not improved or kept pace with the drilling technology is the cleanup technology. We are still in the Stone Ages as far as cleanup technology is concerned. I'm actually intrigued by one of the exhibitors here who's developed some technology that looks a little different. The other, I think, more troubling issue is all of the smaller oil spills we never hear about.
Mm.
And I happened to be witness to one of them in the middle of the South Atlantic this past March, at a place you've probably never heard of, the most remote inhabited island in the world, Tristan da Cunha, and neighboring Nightingale Island. It is the second largest concentration of seabirds in the world. And our ship responded to a distress call of a container ship, Greek container ship that ran aground. This was carrying soybeans, no big deal. Except the fuel it was using, 300,000 gallons of marine oil, was being delivered to the doorstep of one of the most ecologically sensitive areas in the world, including the northern rockhopper penguin, which has already declined nearly 90% over the last 50 years. It's a long story, but the lessons are clear. We just had a similar disaster in New Zealand. They're dealing with that right as we speak. Increased traffic of oil-containing ships is not something that's been talked about in this dialogue, but needs to be, because Cuba has the potential of becoming one of the largest exporters of oil in the region if their estimates end up at the high end. And Jorge Piñon can speak with more authority about those estimates. So, of course, we are all very concerned about this. I've been working in Cuba for 11 years. It is some of the most gratifying work of my career. It's also some of the most frustrating work of my career. Cuba has gifted scientists and treasured ecosystems, some of the healthiest ecosystems I have ever seen in my life. And pardon the self-promotion, but in the next panel, right here in this room, I will show some video of that I shot this summer of healthy coral reefs in Cuba, healthier than any reefs I've seen in my entire life, and I've been diving since I was 15. Now, few people realize that...
David, why are they so healthy?
That's what we want to find out.
Is it because of lack of tourism? Is it because of...
Well, I think it's a combination of things. It is the fact that they have not followed the rest of the developed world's lead, especially in the Caribbean region and Florida, in terms of coastal development. They have been forced to practice organic farming after the Soviet Union pulled out. No fertilizers were available. They didn't have the funds for that, so nutrient pollution went down. And establishment of strong protected areas. Cuba has dedicated, has committed to establishing 25% of its waters in protected areas, and they're up to about 15% of that right now. In comparison, the U.S. is hovering maybe at 1%. So the truth is, though, we have not quantitatively been able to look at this issue. The theory is that if you protect coral reefs locally and these local threats, that they will be more resilient to some of the global threats. But we all know that, and Ixtoc was a great example of that, that oil and coral don't mix very well.
Can you talk to us a little bit, since you have been in Cuba for the last 10, 11 years, about their scientists and their access to information? The United States has an embargo with Cuba, but the rest of the world doesn't. How well-trained are they? How give us a picture of
Sure.
who we're talking about when we're talking about Cuban scientists or environmentalists.
Cuban scientists are very well-trained. They are very talented, knowledgeable, and very dedicated. And yet they are working with the most under the most difficult conditions with the most primitive equipment. My primary partner, our primary partner at the Ocean Foundation, is the University of Havana's Centro de Investigaciones Marinas, the Center for Marine Research. It is the only institution in Cuba where marine biologists are certified. Their only research vessel is literally made out of rock. It's like a Flintstones boat. It's ferro cement. And it's very old and barely, until recently, barely seaworthy. We also had an awful tragedy this summer. One of our colleagues who was supposed to accompany us on an expedition in South Cuba died in a tragic accident when a scuba tank he was filling exploded. The tank was minted in 1985 and had not been properly inspected. Like so many other things, like the cars on the road in Cuba, they nurse any material asset as long as they possibly can. These things are precious, and it resulted in the loss of life of a very talented 40-year-old marine technician.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have good access to information. They're free to travel. The problem is simple things that we take for granted, like Wi-Fi and internet. Wi-Fi, internet is very slow. Telecommunications are awful. The center that I mentioned has one telephone line for the entire building. So access to information becomes a real challenge. And that's why we have been working with Dan Whittle at Environmental Defense Fund and many other U.S. NGOs to build strong partnerships to share information. And 4 years ago, we established the Tri-National Initiative for Marine Research and Conservation in the Gulf of Mexico and Western Caribbean. Very long title. But the idea was, including Mexico, Cuba, and the United States, to elevate collaboration in marine science and conservation to a new level. And that has worked in terms of sharing information. But incredibly dedicated, hardworking people.
What's their biggest concern when it comes to oil drilling?
I think what we're finding is that Cuba's marine resources are incredibly healthy, and at the same time, they've barely explored many of these coastal areas. And of course, they have concerns that we may be developing in areas that we don't even know about. Certainly, the deep water habitats are untouched very little exploration has been done in areas below diver depth, for example, until our project in Cuba's Gulf of Mexico, which has been going on for almost 9 years now. There was almost no data on that coast of Cuba, everything from Havana west, and we're finding it rich with corals, including Acropora palmata, the elkhorn coral, which is one of the most important reef-building corals, which is 95% gone from the Caribbean, but doing incredibly well in Cuban waters. So the colleagues of mine at the University of Havana, when Cupet first was studying this issue after Fidel made the announcement of the oil discovery, showed me some modeling studies that they had done on the trajectory of oil from a blowout. And the modeling, of course, subject to all the scenarios, the different scenarios and variability that we heard about earlier, but the predominance of those models showed 90% of that oil would end up in the Florida Keys and up the east coast of Florida. It's no surprise to anybody who knows those currents. They're swift and they're powerful, and that means that we have hours to react, not days to react.
Are the currents consistent all year long or more marked during hurricane season?
Well, they do vary. It's a river at sea, essentially, mm-hmm. and it wiggles and wobbles. And this past year, in fact, during Deepwater Horizon, the loop current was configured in such a way that the oil from Deepwater Horizon was doing a beeline for northwestern Cuba. And we started hearing from our colleagues, Dan and I, what's going on, guys? What can you tell us? We need information. And we also called a meeting in Washington, D.C. At our offices at the Ocean Foundation. We had State Department, Coast Guard, NOAA. We had the U.S. Interest Section in Havana on the line, Coast Guard officer down there, and saying, how are we going to react? How are we going to respond if this oil actually makes it to Cuba? We are not set up. We are completely flat-footed. We need licenses to be issued. The rules and regulations, because of the embargo, are very clear. This requires huge amounts of paperwork, and Dan and I have the scars on our back of getting licenses. We probably do, too, of getting licenses over
different
the...
different scars.
Yeah, right. But it is not an easy process, and as Dan will tell you, we need to have these things in place immediately. The people at State, the people at the agencies were great. They were saying, look, we'll do what it takes, but they would always qualify their remarks by saying, but it's not under our control. We don't have the authorization. We have to get that authorization. And in an emergency, if this happened this afternoon, we could not respond mm-hmm. by tomorrow. There's no way.
Dan, when we look at these issues, and you certainly have, as David was indicating, the United States does have certain relationships with the Cuban government. We have military operations. There are military discussions that go on from time to time, dealing with immigration, with drug intervention, and so on. It wouldn't be unusual for the two governments, and it's not just two governments, it's a number of governments who are working in this project here for Cuba Drilling, for the United States to be able to come up with a plan to work with Cuba on this. Or is there something particularly cumbersome because, as David indicates, the embargo really impedes the process?
Thank you, Helen. First of all, let me ask real quick, who's been to Cuba in this room? Excellent. Thank you. That helps. The U.S. and Cuba do have a long history of talking to each other. Since 1963, I believe, NOAA has been engaged with the Cuban Meteorological Institute on hurricanes, and we've had a very vigorous exchange of information and expertise on how to track follow and respond to hurricanes since then. I've participated in delegations in New Orleans and in Havana, where Cuban and Americans have come together to compare notes on how to respond to disasters. In New Orleans, about 150 people showed up to hear from two Cubans on how they get people out of harm's way whenever there's a hurricane, a major hurricane, which is every year. So there is a foundation in place. We interact with Cubans on migration, on narcotics, on natural disasters. Following the Haiti earthquake, there was good cooperation between the two governments. So it does exist. So any notion that, gee, we can't talk to the Cubans on oil and gas for fear that somehow it erodes the embargo or it means we're going soft on Cuba, you know, that's just not accurate at all. Since 2009, my group has been, along with David Guggenheim, has been very involved in trying to facilitate environmental dialogue and cooperation. And we start through scientific exchanges. For many years in the 2000s, Cuban scientists simply could not get visas to come to the United States. They were essentially cut off. So beginning in April 2000, I was in Havana and was talking about my projects, and my main partner there said, Dan, you know, hold tight. We'll talk about your projects in Cuba, but first we want a U.S. action. I was like, what's that mean? And he said, we want to come to the United States. I was like, oh, great. You know, that's going to slow everything down. And, you know, lo and behold, 4 months later, we had a delegation of four Cuban scientists eating hot dogs at Ben's Chili Bowl in Washington, D.C. at 12:30 at night. And our waitress actually heard that we had Cuban doctors there. It was very interesting in getting some attention. But that's a great story we can talk about later. But
sure.
But since then, we've had over 40 Cuban scientists that I've been involved in bringing to the U.S. This afternoon, I'll be going to the airport. One of Cuba's leading marine biologists, who David and I both work with, is coming here for about 3 weeks. And so,
on this issue with...
Not on this issue. On working together on coral reefs and on studying the connection of fish populations. So we have a foundation on the environment. We government agencies, Department of Interior, NOAA, Fish and Wildlife, and even within the State Department, government scientists are very, very eager to begin interacting with Cuban counterparts. They have for some time. So we're making the case that this is the perfect issue, the bridge, if you will, to bring our two countries together. We simply can't afford not to. And so I believe there is some movement. I'm worried that it's piecemeal. I have had several meetings with the administration in recent weeks. There was a Senate hearing this week that Dr. Pignon spoke at. There is movement. There is interest to do something, but there is... people are still afraid to do too much because it's Cuba. And so my concern is that we're going to miss a huge opportunity. We're just talking about one well.
And right now it's exploratory. It's an exploratory well to determine initially how much oil is available.
That's right. And let me remind everyone that the BP blowout, the Macondo well, was an exploratory well. So on the one hand, it's just one well, and that's actually good news. When Cuba develops its offshore oil fields, there are a lot of impacts that come with oil and gas development, even without a spill. And David touched upon some of those.
Mm-hmm.
But there's air quality concerns, water quality concerns, concerns on habitat.
And John was talking about sound, the
exactly,
issue of sound,
exactly.
And how that would affect and impact fishing patterns.
There are onshore impacts associated with accommodating you know, the oil, the facilities, et cetera. So you know, we're dealing with one well, but there's a great sense of urgency to be prepared.
Dan, let me ask you something, because when you see the potential of what is happening, of the amount of oil, gas that you can find off Cuba's shore, then, of course, there are other Caribbean countries that say, well, we share similar
right.
waters. Maybe we have that capability also. So is there a possibility of forming a new organization or a new partnership where we incorporate the United States and the entire Caribbean and Mexican region, the Gulf area, to be able to deal with issues, because you can't tell Jamaica, you can't tell the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. Heck, in Florida, there's constantly discussion about drilling. It could be the right opportunity to forming this new synergy, political synergy, mm-hmm. and environmental synergy as well.
Absolutely. That's a great point. The U.S. And Mexico work very closely together and have since 1980, following the major Ixtoc spill. There are regional and international bodies already established that we could tap into. In fact, there's a meeting in the Bahamas in December of the International Maritime Organization. And the purpose is to look at regional compacts, regional agreements that could be forged. The Bahamas are very eager to develop oil, even closer than the Cuban mm-hmm. oil fields. Bahama oil development could affect the East Coast like nobody's business. And so, yeah, it's a good opportunity. I think politically, it's a smart opportunity. It really demonstrates that this is not a Cuba issue. It's an environmental and economic issue.
Now, if this were to happen, David, for example, if the Bahamas were to develop, those currents would take it up to the northeastern part. The northeastern states would be the most affected, or no?
Again, it depends where the Gulf Stream
decides to wiggle. Because the United States doesn't care about South Florida way too much.
No,
if it would affect the northeastern states where you have... centers of power, then they would actually move.
It could, but it might hit the Carolinas on mm-hmm. the way, and that might be a more likely scenario. But again, it's very dynamic ecosystem, it all depends on the season and what's going on there. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to emphasize one point that Dan made about the importance. I mean, what Dan and I are really pushing for, and Jorge as well is we need to get in the same room with Cuba and work these things out. It needs a face-to-face dialogue.
Do they want that?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
They've been very clear with us that they would always welcome this sort of dialogue.
And the United States says?
Well, the United States speaks with many different tongues, unfortunately. The National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling, co-chaired by former Governor of Florida and U.S. Senator Bob Graham and former EPA Administrator Bill Riley, it states, it is in our country's national interests to negotiate now with these near neighbors to agree, and referring to Mexico and Cuba, to agree on a common rigorous set of standards, a system for regulatory oversight, and the same operator adherence to the effective safety culture called for in this report, along with protocols to cooperate on containment and response strategies and repair and preparedness in case of a spill. So they were very explicit about face-to-face getting together with Cuba and Mexico to develop standards, safety standards, and response preparedness mm-hmm. strategies in the Gulf of Mexico. And we strongly support that. Bill Riley actually accompanied Dan to Cuba recently with a delegation. I know Bob Graham is eager to visit Cuba as well to push through on and follow through on the Commission's recommendations. There are many in the administration that support these words, but of course we all know the political reality of this. And I, for one, was very disappointed at the Senate hearing. I thought Jorge did an awesome job, by the way, for the record. But the Senate hearing earlier this week, first of all, why did it take until the platform is on its way to Cuba to have a Senate hearing about something we've known about for more than 5 years?
That's right.
And second, this issue, even though the witnesses at the committee were making it clear that this sort of dialogue was critical, the senators there, especially on the Republican side of the aisle, were using it as an opportunity to say, well, the best way that we can be prepared for foreign oil is to further develop our own domestic sources of oil. and saying, this is madness. If other countries can drill off our shores, then we should be able to drill off our own shores. You know, there's a certain logic that I don't quite understand, except shameless, self-serving advocacy.
Jorge Piñon, you spoke you were invited to speak to a Senate committee on this issue. Number one, to the best of your knowledge, what's the U.S. government focusing on? What do they see as the fundamental points that the United States needs to do? And number two, is the United States asking the right questions?
First of all, it's important for you folks to know the messenger better than the message itself. And there is an issue for transparency and full disclosure that I'd like to mention. My background is not that of an environmentalist.
You work for the dark side.
I'm on the dark side. So please hold the booze.
You worked for oil companies.
I was for the oil industry for 32 years. I'm the former president of Amoco Oil Latin America. And I was based in Mexico City in 1999. When BP and Amoco merged, BP transferred me to Europe, and I was in Spain with BP running the Southern Europe assets for 5 years until I retired from BP in 2003. So now you can boo if you would like to do so. I'm also a Cuban-American, and I'm a Cuban-American from the Historicos. I came here in 1960 at a very young age. The scars in my back that Helen was talking about is that my travels to Cuba and my public position on this issue also sometimes causes us a little bit of a headache when we go to Calle Ocho and have a cafecito. That's also a challenge. It was very interesting, the Tuesday hearing at the Senate, and I want to be sure that the Tuesday hearing at the Senate was not about Cuba. The Tuesday hearing at the Senate was about oil and gas drilling activities in the OCS in EECs adjacent to the United States. Russia is about to drill on the Chukchi Sea on the other side of our EEC in Alaska. The Canadians are drilling off Sable Island in Maine. Mexico just took delivery of Bicentenario, a brand new semi-submersible sixth-generation rig built in Korea. That is going to move into the Perdido Fault, only 20 miles south of the U.S. line of the EEC, off Texas. And we know the experience that Mexico has with Ixtoc. Cuba, of course, is Carabeo 9, is on its way. It's now going through southern Africa on its way to Namibia, and then on to Belém to pick up fuel, and on to Trinidad and Tobago before arriving in Cuba in the first week of December. And then the Bahamas are going to begin drilling next year after the elections south of Andros Island. By the way, on the topic of the Bahamas, it would be Cuba the most likely impacted by a spill in the Bahamas, not the eastern coast, because of the currents on the Bahama Channel where the drilling is going to be occur. So it's all of Cuba's northern coast that's going to be impacted by an accident in the Bahamas. Also good news is, and it will show you the high probability that there is oil in the Bahama Fault. Cuba and the Bahamas, after almost 20 years of discussions in their EEC, signed their EEC last month in Nassau. So now if there is a reservoir, and that reservoir is a transboundary reservoir and it has to be unitized, the Bahamas now and Cuba jointly can develop the reservoir in the Bahamas Channel. Helen, what I would like to do is set up four very important issues from the oil point of view that I think that merit further debate this morning. In our business, the success of an upstream project depends on four key factors. One is capital. Each one of these wells that are going to be drilled in Cuba is about a $100 million enterprise. The Scarabeo 9 costs about $755 million. $86 to $89 million of that was cost overrun just to bypass the embargo.
And for those who may not be aware, Jorge, the Scarabeo 9 is the Italian.
Let me get there. The daily rental rate of the Scarabeo 9 is $511,000 a day. That is just the daily rental rate for the equipment. I'm not talking about the whole project. The Wall Street Journal article on Tuesday, just to show you, and again, you're a journalist, and that's why Dan and I were in a teleconference yesterday. I was in Washington, D.C. Dan was somewhere in the mountainside in California on the phone, hopefully safely, standing on, by the side of the road. We were talking to the press because it is very important for you folks to understand the facts. The headline in the Wall Street article by Russell Gold, a very good friend of mine with the Wall Street Journal, said, Coast Guard to inspect Cuba rig. Cuban rig. So my BlackBerry started saying, is the rig owned by the Cubans? Did the Cubans build it? The Cubans don't know how to build rigs. So right away, the whole Cuban rig thing that the headline in the Wall Street Journal put forward just threw the debate totally out of line. It is beautiful in Washington to call this a Chinese rig. Why? Because that means the Chinese are coming. And all of us, again, it's a political maneuvering sometimes how we label these little things depending what political side of the equation you're in. This is a rig that is Norwegian design. It's sixth generation Frigstad D90 design, the most modern design so far. The structure was built in China. The components were put together in Singapore. It is owned by Saipem, which is an Italian company, very well experienced in North Sea operations, which is owned by Eni, the Italian oil the national oil company of Italy. So again, just to show you the rig, that is the complexity of the rig. But going back, the four key components are capital, technology, know-how, and then number four is stewardship, which is very, very important. The equipment is top of the line. You could argue that, well, the Deepwater Horizon was also top of the line. All that I can say is that this rig has a lot of things in it that came out of the experience that we had out of the Deepwater Horizon. By the way, the blowout preventer, it is the only piece of equipment that is U.S. made, and it's the only piece of equipment that falls within the 10% limitation of the U.S. embargo. And the reason that it is U.S. made, which is a couple of points that this guy has brought up, is that in the case of an emergency, we need quick access to take care of that issue, which is critical in the rig. So within the 10% limitation of the U.S. embargo on the Scarabeo 9, the blowout preventer, I cannot tell you right now who the manufacturer is, but it is a U.S. manufacturer based in Houston. Number two is the operator. Who is the operator? Well, it just happens that the first exploratory drill well that is going to be drilled is Repsol, which, by the way, it is the only privately held company that is operating in Cuba. All the other companies that are operating in Cuba are state-owned oil companies. Okay, so Repsol is the first one, which, by the way, it is a very good deep-water operator. Repsol just recently, last year, drilled Buckskin. Buckskin was a project about 180 miles south of Houston that was a total depth of 32,000 feet. It was, at that time, it broke a record, and Repsol was the operator of that project. But Repsol is the whipping boy. And as soon as the Scarabeo 9 finishes with Repsol drilling the Hawaii project, which is about 22 miles north of Havana, about 68 nautical miles southwest of the Marquesas, the Scarabeo goes over to Petronas, which is the national oil of Malaysia, in association with Gazprom from Russia. But since the United States has not and is not willing to establish any relationship with Petronas, it's going to go into a black hole. Because Repsol was the only company over which we had some sort of leverage because they own assets in the U.S. But the reason that we beat up Repsol was because of the Cuban-American community in South Florida. Because what the Cuban-American community in South Florida were hoping was that if we scare enough Repsol and if we bully Repsol, Repsol would have said, we're out of here, and everybody else would have followed, and then nothing would have happened. The whole thing has backfired because Repsol has more than about $220, $222 million invested in this thing, And it looks like there is a very high probability that there is oil in Cuba. So Repsol was not going to be scared away. So now we have put ourselves in a situation, Helen, again talking about U.S. policy, that as soon as this Carabeo finishes with Repsol, by the way, the Repsol has bent over backwards, the Coast Guard has talked to them, they have talked to the Coast Guard, they have shared information, by the way, that put them at risk with the Cuban government because of the confidentiality agreement with the Cuban government. So Repsol has bent over backwards to serve their own interests in the United States? Sure, no question about it. But the point is now that when that rig moves over to Petronas, it's a dark hole. We don't know what they're going to do.
Well,
why is it a dark hole?
Because we have Petronas is a very, don't get me wrong, Petronas is an experienced oil company, from Malaysia. But we have not established any type of working relationships. The whole thing, the thing that these two guys do is sick. The most important things that these two guys do is not their technical and scientific work, by the way. It's when they have a cup of coffee with the Cubans. It's when they have a hot dog with the Cubans. That's what established relationships. And those relationships is then what eventually lead you to success in the scientific area, in the business area, and so on. We are not willing to sit down with the Cubans and have a cafecito. It is sacred.
So you're saying that Repsol is the opportunity. It's the current bridge that we have.
All of these companies, whether it's Repsol, whether it's Petronas. By the way, from Petronas, it goes to ONGC of India. It goes back to Repsol. Let me finish because I know that Pignon likes to talk a lot, but I need to finish two more important points, and then I'll stop. One is the regulations. All three of us have seen the extent of the Cuban regulations. They are literally copying all of the latest regulations from the US, the UK, everywhere. At the end of this process, the Cubans are going to come up with a red book, and they're going to show it to you, and all of you guys are going to say, wow, these are the best regulations in the world. You folks, better than anybody else, know that regulations without enforcement are zero. They are worthless. I have been to countries in Latin America in the oil and gas business that you would go, wow. But they don't have the infrastructure, resources, people, personnel, training, money. They don't have the rule of law by which to enforce the regulations. So what we need to work with the Cubans, again, is what these two guys are doing. They're having to go to Brazil. They're having to go to Canada. They have asked the Norwegian government to come to Cuba, and the Norwegians have come to Cuba to train them and help them in enforcing the regulations. Lastly is the plan. We need a plan in order to manage the incident. Regrettably, whether we like it or not, I come from an industry that is inherently high risk. I don't care if it's a Deepwater Horizon or a truck full of fuel leaving Port Everglades, like it happened about 3 or 4 years ago. The driver took a turn too fast, spilled over, turned over, and killed a family of four. The issue is how we as human beings manage the risk and assume responsibility for the risk. So as far as Cuba is concerned, the equipment, operator, regulations, and plan, I mean, that's the bad thing about being the last guy on a panel. You want to answer a ton of things that the other guys, or at least add value to it. But those, Helen, are my four things that I wanted to bring to the table.
Okay, I have a ton of questions, but I'd like to open it up to the audience to see if you have any questions first and give you priority in line. If you do have a question, please just raise your hand, acknowledge. Yes, ma'am. Can you identify yourself, please?
Dr. Eden Ritter, the Ocean Research Conservation Association. When you talk about managing risk, in the nuclear industry, we manage risk by having backup upon backup upon backup, and that can fail. But for oil drilling, why not require that a relief well be drilled at the same time as the main shaft?
The question is, and excuse me, I've been asked to repeat the question so that it can be properly recorded. The question is, why not have a relief well to be put in to be able to be a safety measure in the case of a crisis?
That is certainly a question and an issue that has been debated, and it is being debated.
It's about money. They can't afford to do it.
Yes, ma'am.
We can't afford to do it, and we can't afford not to do it.
The point is,
can we really, Jorge Piñon, can we really not afford to do it? Can the oil industry really not afford to do it?
If the conversation is going to go off Cuba as far as the industry is concerned and the whole issue of oil drilling, we can go there. But that's certainly not my intention.
No. But if safety is an economic issue, and we're talking about, and the reason we're talking about Cuba oil drilling is because it might affect
regulations,
the United States.
Regulations are going to come forward, and eventually the industry is going to have to end up operating under those set of rules. Now, the issue is also, this is a foreign country. Okay, so you'll have to talk to the Mexicans about their regulations. You're going to have to talk to Russia about their regulations. By the way, I think the Cubans should actually have the right to inspect U.S. rigs drilling in the Gulf of Mexico.
You're here.
Okay, so if we keep telling the Cubans what to do, let me tell you, the Cubans are the first ones that have to ask Chevron and Exxon and Conoco and Marathon, I want to inspect your rigs. Not only do I want to inspect your rigs, I want to take a look at your drilling programs. So the issue here in the conversation in this panel, forgive me, I'm not an upstream guy. I mean, it's really to talk about the Cuba issue. But again, the answer is yes, sure.
Yes, sir.
There's any sense of what Cuban public opinion is on this issue of drilling off their shores?
That's a good question. The question is there a sense of what Cuban public opinion is regarding offshore drilling off their shores?
Now, it's a hard one to read fully. Cuba, one thing that I love about Cuba is that people are passionate about the natural environment there. Mm-hmm. There is none of this divide that we have, unfortunately, in this country on the environment. It is seemingly universally treasured, and they are very proud of their environment, especially when they hear the perspective of a foreigner coming in and saying, wow, this is amazing. On the other hand, times are hard, and you know, there's not abject poverty, but the standard of living is very low, and you have to work very, very hard. Most people have several jobs, one official and a couple unofficial, to make ends meet. And the economic situation, while it was getting better for a while, in the last few years has really taken a tumble, and things are very difficult. You may have heard that the government is now laying off about 500,000 people. The free lunches that were being given out at the university are no longer. Things like this. It's affecting everybody's life. So the very notion of energy independence, possibly becoming an energy exporter, and having a revenue source, I think, appeals to people in a big way. And I think, like many of us, regarding the oil industry in the United States, it's a necessary evil. Sorry. You know, we with wishful thinking, you know, we know we're addicted to oil, but we know we need it. And, you know, but at the same time, I don't think most people know a whole lot. Mm-hmm. About the offshore drilling, I think the problem is people just aren't very aware of what's going on.
Yeah, let me jump in real quick. I agree. I'm not sure that the Cuban population is fully informed about the current events. However, a couple quick things. During the BP oil spill in Cuba, there was some public alarm about going into the water because there was some concern that the sharks were being driven. Yeah. From U.S. waters to Cuban waters, and so there was a public relations effort to disabuse people of that notion. So people are generally aware. People are aware that Cuba has promising oil reserves. They've also been living with blackouts. In 2004, 2005, when I was down there, blackouts every day. There's something called the Energy Revolution. That Cubans are very aware of. You see it on billboards everywhere. Efficiency has been a major focus. The Cuban government has literally come into people's houses and replaced 1958 American refrigerators with Chinese models, same thing with air conditioners. So they're very aware of how important energy is and how important it is. And they're also very aware that Cuba is dependent upon Venezuela for Cuban oil. So I would venture a guess that most Cubans would support offshore development simply because of the need and mm-hmm. and the promise for the economy.
But there's a Dan and I were in Trinidad and Tobago at a meeting in which Cuban officials came. And again, just to show you how we, how you say, cut our nose in spite of our face.
Yeah.
Dan and I were in Trinidad and Tobago, which is a third independent country. And there was an American industry group there, and we wanted the Cubans to come. We have to ask the United States government permission for the Cubans to go to Trinidad and Tobago to meet with us. Just to show you the complexity and the absurdity of this, Cubans, we have to ask permission to the United States government for the Cubans to go to a third country so that we could have a cup of coffee and a conversation on this subject. Because the hotel where we were staying and the venue was paid by U.S. interest and U.S. money. So we could have met outside of the gate, we could have met in the lobby, but the Cubans could not have come into the meeting room because the meeting room was paid with U.S. money, just to show you. But in that meeting in Trinidad and Tobago, the question was raised, are the Cubans really interested in all this stuff? I mean, are they really concerned? Are they going to follow the regulations? Let me remind you that today, Cuba's largest income stream is tourism, $2 billion a day. And if you think that we're putting pressure on the Cubans, we, the United States, the Consejo de Estado is putting 100 times more pressure on Cuba's authorities, because this oil that we're talking about is not going to come in stream until 5 to 7 years from now. So the Cubans are jeopardizing, if there is a spill, their economic livelihood goes, I mean, down the drain. Because right now, right away, Varadero, even if it doesn't hit Varadero, just the mere issue of a spill in Cuban waters, they'll be out of business. So the Cuban government, the Consejo de Estado, is telling Mimbas and Cupet and all these guys, wait a minute, you're telling me that you're going to drill a hole that can have a blowout, whose economic benefit out of that exercise is 7 years away, but you're putting in jeopardy a guaranteed stream of revenue of $2 billion a year? So if you guys think that the Cubans are not under pressure, if you folks think that the Cubans are not going to try to do the best job possible and force the Petronas and the Repsols to do the best job possible, you folks in this room don't know anything about Cuba.
John, what questions should journalists be asking from your perspective that doesn't get answered or doesn't get asked?
Well,
could you pass the microphone? Thank you.
I think that the notion of how should we go about understanding what might happen, what might be an impact, is the same question that would occur in the United States and in Cuba. There's a saying in the environmental community that you don't know what is abnormal until you know what is normal. So there is a certain lack of information, the baseline information, about the health of the reefs in the United States and in Cuba. So I think that a first question could be is what form of actions in a common type of issue are being contemplated? What is the scientific underpinning of the Cuban response to an American response to a problematic release? What is to be done? So how is the scientific community preparing? How is that scientific community merging with the operational community? And I can say that there is some work going on in this area. So I would say that these are the kind of things. The question of control and inspection isn't very clear, because if you look at where issues can ultimately reside, if you think about how was the exclusive economic zone first defined, what are the sections of the law of the sea that might apply here, how do you apply to situations which are asymmetric in risk-benefit ratios? It's oftentimes that you do not have symmetry in the risk-benefit ratio of the development of coastal resources. I think all of these things need to be contemplated and looked at again, not only in the case of Cuban oil, but in the issue of transshipment, the post-expansion of the Panama Canal. There's a host of these kind of issues that are intertwined.
And that's such an important point that you raised, the impact that the expansion of the Panama Canal is going to have on the shipping industry, which you had talked about earlier. Dan?
I think there's a question out here.
Yes, sir.
David Helbart, I'm an author, a CJA member. Obviously, the sharks are being drawn by Cuba, Malaysia, just makes me curious. I mean, the U.S. Chamber has long wanted to ban Cuba being part of. I'm wondering if the American Petroleum Institute, the Wall Street Institute Association, these folks are getting into this as in response to the
The question is, is the API looking to advocate better relationships with Cuba?
Off the record for a minute, put your pencils down. I know, I do, which is fine. I have been in conversations with the API. The API basically is out of the purview of the API. It's an international issue. Let me then go to the majors. Cuba is not important for the Exxons and the Chevrons, the Marathons and the Conocos, which are the four major U.S. corporations, because of the size of the enterprise. It's Brazil, Angola, U.S. Gulf. Those are things that are bigger. I can tell you that who is interested are the United States petroleum supply and equipment providers. I had a meeting with Senator Landrieu from Louisiana staff, and again, this rig is coming in with workers from the UK and Norway. This could be U.S. workers coming out of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas where they need jobs. That's number one. Number two, where they're well experienced. So it's not only the issue of that. The embargo is going to have a huge impact on what happens. A general license is needed. And the reason that a general license is needed because in the issue of prevention, if you have a problem with a valve and you need to get it like now, you cannot afford to go to the bureaucratic process. You have to call Cameron out of Houston and get the valve. It is very naive in the hearing on Tuesday that people didn't recognize that it wasn't just the valve. That valve now has to be put on a C-130 airplane. The C-130 right. airplane has to be cleared to fly to Cuba. Who are the pilots? Does the valve has to come with experts? Exactly. Do they have visas? Have anybody talked to the Cubans to see if the airplane can land in Havana? So, I mean, Washington is extremely naive. I mean, I'm sure you guys are not surprised about this, but to me, it is terribly surprising how naive Washington is.
Yeah, I just want to add to that. Washington is having a conversation with itself, which probably is not new. But the more questions we ask ourselves, the more complicated it all gets. After the Senate hearing, it became clear that there are a lot of assumptions we're making about inspecting rigs, about landing in Cuba that simply are incorrect. And so it's critical that the dialogue start now, because when the rig shows up, it will be too late. We'll be scrambling. We'll repeat the same mistakes we made in the summer of 2010. The Cubans' position has been very clear and consistent. They stand ready to enter into a dialogue with the U.S. at a technical level and at a senior diplomatic level. With Bill Riley in September, we had a meeting with Bruno Rodriguez, the foreign minister, and he stated that very clear to us. So the question I would ask is, what's next? What can we do to treat this issue as an economic and environmental issue for the United States, and what steps should be taken?
In a nutshell, are you saying that the U.S. government learned very little
Let me add something. There's one organization that I will ask for you guys to talk to, because it's the only one that's way ahead of everyone and is really trying to tackle the problem, and it is the U.S. Coast Guard. Why? Because they're the ones that are going to have to handle the whole blankety-blank mess. And let me tell you that the guys here in Miami in the 7th District, and I've been in 5 meetings with them. I've been in 2 meetings in Key West. I've been in, with 1 meeting in Port Everglades and 2 meetings here. The 7th Coast Guard District, please talk to them. They're dying to talk to you.
But
because they are ready. They are prepared. They're getting everything. But they're getting everything ready to defend the U.S. coastline. And they're saying, please, let us work also so we can go and take care of the problem on the other side.
But so, they are totally squeezed as well. Vice Admiral Salerno at the hearing, I just wrote down a few things he said. We do not have immediate authority to respond. Cuba, of course, is a special case, and we'd have to defer to the interagency command. We do not have pre-authorization to do anything in a foreign EEZ. We'd be dependent on the State Department.
Correct. What was the response of the Senate panel?
Drill, baby, drill. I mean, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but this was frustrating. They did not pick up on this issue at all. And you know, if we need assets on the ground, as Jorge vividly illustrated, we need to respond in the moment, which means all of this paperwork has to be done now, and there has to be an overarching plan to tell people what to do when the inevitable happens.
I know you have something to say, but we have a little bit of a time crunch. I just want to get a sense how many questions more are out here. Okay, could you say your 2 questions, you first, and then we'll just take them all together.
I'm Matthew Daly with the Associated Press. Just want to talk a little bit about, I came a little bit late, so you may have already addressed this, but just, you know, with the Castro brothers and the government, what's expected to happen the next few years, and how is that
going to
affect
the
challenge?
Yeah.
And yours, sir? Your
yeah, just a follow-up on what Jorge said. I wrote Rescue Waters on the Coast Guard. It's out there. Excellent.
Great book.
Not only for issues related to Cuba, and it's also the Arctic. I mean, these people actually have a lot of real-world information that we're not accessing here on these reporters. And unlike the other services, they not only allow their people to act on their own, but speak on their own, speak for themselves.
Okay, thank you. Now, let me just repeat the question to make sure that it's properly recorded. The question, in essence, is, given the nature of possible changes within the Cuban government, how solid, what can you expect in the future regarding this discussion?
Let me first, let's go back, again, you guys are journalists. Let me go back, and we even have a journalism professor here. Let's go back to the headline of the Wall Street Journal, Coast Guard to Inspect. The Coast Guard cannot inspect. All that the Coast Guard does on a rig, because it is a vessel, is issue a certificate of seaworthiness. That is the limit of the U.S. Coast Guard authority over a vessel. The Coast Guard doesn't have the slightest idea what a blowout preventer looks like. That's number one. Number two, they're going to inspect a rig that is owned by a third-party company overseas by which they don't have any authority over because it's not coming into U.S. waters. So what happened is that you folks are going to publish the U.S. Coast Guard inspected. People are going to relax all of a sudden because they say, oh, the rig is inspected by the Coast Guard. So everything must be okay. We don't have to worry about it. How naive can we be? So be very careful, but the Coast Guard is dying, really, to work together. There were a couple of remarks made here about Cuba being an exporter. Cuba will probably produce, out of all of these reservoirs, the 4 to 5 billion barrels net, because remember, this is a 60-40 split, so the operators get 40% of the oil, about 131,000 barrels a day over a 25-year span period. Cuba today consumes about 147. There's a study, which again goes back to you environmentally folks, to talk about the Cuba of the future and why coral reefs in Cuba are so clean, is because of the embargo, really, in a way. Cuba's oil demand today is only about 131. Rice University estimates that under an open economic system, Cuba's consumption will double to about 300,000 barrels a day. For example, Cuba only consumes about 8,000 barrels a day of gasoline. Why? Because there are very little cars. The Dominican Republic consumes about 22,000 barrels a day of gasoline. Puerto Rico consumes 56,000 barrels a day of gasoline. So you can imagine when the Cuban economy changes and you got all the tourists running, all the Cubans in Miami driving their cars in the ferry over, Cuba's oil consumption again, going back to the James Baker Institute, Rice University, it will double. So the impact to Cuba, the answer from the it's long term. Short term economic benefit to Cuba is very little, or if any. People are saying, "Oh, we cannot allow the," and you use the word the Castro brothers, which means that your question is politically oriented vis-a-vis Miami in the way you present it. The Castro brothers are not going to benefit because the monetization of that oil is still 7 to 10 years away, unless you think that the Castro brothers could, they were, very well be, still be around 10 years from now.
I just like to add, first, just a minor point, but maybe not a minor point, that some of the upward estimates were beyond the $4 billion, $4 to $5 billion. So that's where some of these speculation about Cuba being a possible exporter, if it's indeed estimates, as I've seen, as high as $20 billion, but we don't. Of course, we don't know that. The other question about the Castro brothers and the current regime, and the question that probably we get, and certainly Dan and I get more often than anything, is what's going to happen after Castro dies. It's a fair question. It's impossible to predict. My own personal opinion is I don't see revolution in the streets and radical changeover. I think the changeover has already occurred. It's incremental. It's moving ahead. And so the work that we are doing in negotiating, in working with the Cubans to develop environmental policies and so on, we've adopted the philosophy that the policies that are based on the best, most defensible science and are open and transparent, and yes, even subject to public participation, which is something that Dan and I have both pushed for in Cuba, and we've had public meetings, very interesting dynamics. Those are the policies that, in our estimation, have the best chance of surviving changes, even radical changes to a new regime. You still have many of the same players there, and credibility is at the base of everything that we're trying to accomplish. So, you know, again, getting a little philosophical here, but I think that it's the heavy lifting is trying to do the best possible painstaking work of making decisions based on strong science.
How is this project?
How will this project affect the U.S.-Cuba relationship? That is the key question.
Yes.
Because I think what's holding up the administration is somehow a concern that this issue cannot be handled as an environmental and economic issue, that it opens Pandora's box. It gets into Cuba policy. The administration doesn't want to get into Cuba policy. Not right now, anyway. So I, however, think that the environment is a bridge, is a foundation. Environmental diplomacy has been used in other contexts during the Cold War, when we canceled our participation in the Olympics. The U.S. and Cuba, the Fish and Wildlife Services, were communicating. So there's a lot of precedent for constructive engagement beginning with issues of common concern and interest like the environment. So my focus is not on that. My focus is protecting our marine and coastal ecosystems, which are spectacular in both countries. There's so much more that needs to be done, especially on the scientific exchange front. We haven't even begun working with our scientific counterparts to see what's down current, deep water corals, marine life, et cetera. There's so much more that needs to be done. So
it seems like this project is of this size and this magnitude. The amount of money that can be made, and B, the amount of damage that could happen.
Absolutely.
Force a dialogue that isn't happening now, and I'm not really sure why you're not saying that, or what it is that you're saying.
Well, at the Council of Foreign Relations back in December a year ago, there was consensus on the panel on Cuba that this is a game changer. Oil and gas is a game changer. And the event was not about oil and gas, but this is a potential game changer for U.S.-Cuba relations. I believe that's absolutely potential. It shows how connected we are and how it's in our interest to foster better relations I'll let others speak to that.
There's another very important issue, and Washington is very concerned. It doesn't have anything to do with Cuba. If Cuba drills, if Cuba finds oil, that's going to put huge pressure on the administration and the domestic drilling policy.
Absolutely.
In fact, if Cuba finds oil tomorrow, all the baby drill oil folks are going to descend in Washington, D.C. and say, how come the Russians, because they won't say Repsol, they'll say, how come the Russians are drilling in Cuba and the Eastern Gulf is closed? There is a lot of people that are opposed to Cuba drilling, not because of Cuba policy, but because it's going to have an impact in U.S. domestic drilling policy as far as the Eastern Gulf is concerned. Tallahassee is going to be inundated, and Washington is going to be inundated with pro-drill people that are saying they're the Russians drilling in Cuba.
And Jorge, quite frankly, if U.S. shores are at equal risk with or without U.S. domestic drilling, this becomes
Correct.
Even a more critical
Correct.
Issue. We are out of time. I'd like to thank John, Jorge, David, and Dan for a wonderful discussion. They'll be around if you have more questions.